The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Hello, everyone. My name is Ben Mosier, and you're listening to the Agile Uprising podcast.
Greetings, everyone, and welcome to another edition of the Agile Uprising podcast. I'm your host, Jay Hersko. And the topic tonight, you might have seen it bouncing around Twitter. You might have seen it a couple of different places. We are going to talk about Wardley mapping. And as if you couldn't tell by the bumper, joining us tonight to talk about Wardley mapping is Ben Mosier. Ben, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Jay. I really appreciate you having me here.
The pleasure, believe me, Ben, is all mine. So before we get to the mapping piece, let's give our listeners a little bit of background about you. So why don't you give us a little bit of who you are and what you do, and then we'll eventually get into Wardley mapping, how you came across it, and we can go down through the history there.
Fantastic. Yeah. So my name is Ben Mosier. I run a company called Hired Thought, and I am really into this thing called Wardley mapping, and we'll get to that in a second. But my background is largely, I started out in tech. I was a systems administrator. I worked in government for a bit and then moved on to the enterprise space. And over time, I kind of saw an interesting shift happening where instead of focusing only on the technical parts of these systems, I started realizing that there were people. There are people in these systems, my friend. And so I started taking more interest in that and kind of blending the two. So socio-technical systems are kind of the thing I'm really into. And now I'm probably even more biased towards the human side of things. So I love helping people make systems more purposeful, and that's kind of what I do.
Awesome. That's a perfect lead-in. So now, Ben, we're going to talk about Wardley mapping. So for those listeners, I was telling Ben before we started recording that serendipitously this topic landed in my lap. So if you were bouncing around Twitter over the last week or so, you saw that Safe just released their 5.0 map. And a previous guest in the podcast, friend of the podcast, Matt Barkham, put out a funny picture where he said, ha, 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 happy Halloween. And in the new Safe big picture was an icon for Wardley mapping. So that was where I first noticed it. And then I was telling Ben, I came across a blog post by Dave Snowden. I'm a big fan. Somewhere on it was Cognitive Edge, and he talked about Wardley mapping as well. So my thought to myself, okay, well, this is twice in a week that I've seen the same topic for a activity or a practice that I know nothing about, so I need to dig in. So, and the reason why we're all listening to Ben this evening is I was knocking around Google. I found a website, which was actually Hired Thought, which prints up Wardley mapping pads. So I ordered a bunch from Ben, and I was telling him earlier, his shipping time was so good. I ordered it on a Friday, had it on a Monday, and he had a handwritten note there. So I pinged him out of the blue and said, hey, Ben, if you're free and you want to talk about Wardley mapping, let's get on the call. So here we are. So Ben, how did you come across Wardley mapping?
I really appreciate you mentioning the notepads, because as I mentioned before, like, I really loved this whole physical product sort of thing. And I will say the skills that I've had to build in order to do that, I didn't have when I first came across Wardley mapping. And I first came across this, I think Simon was saying some things on Twitter. There was a Medium book I knew I could read. Just people that I was following in these spaces, I think mostly like DevOps-ish kind of things, in terms of the community, were saying that this guy existed and he had this whole thing. You know, I was working with a colleague, and we had kind of a difficult decision to make. Actually, it was we had this opportunity to spend some money, and we were like, oh, well, we never get opportunities to spend money like this. What's going on? Because it was outside the normal budgeting cycle and all this kind of stuff. And the catch was we could only spend it on server hardware. I was like, okay, all right. So the two of us were doing configuration management for enterprise software delivery. So we're sitting in the middle of the entire system, kind of paying attention to what all the humans are doing, what all the systems are doing, what's working, what's not working, which work just shouldn't be done and which work is being done anyway and all this kind of stuff. And along comes this opportunity, right? And we're sitting here going, okay, well, if we're going to buy hardware with this free money that we've got, does that mean we have to invest into our local data center? Does that mean we have to sort of shift our attention from this kind of cloud thing that we've been doing for a while and refocus on just becoming really good at running a local data center? I was like, well, I don't know if we want to do that. That seems like a big decision. That seems like a lot of responsibility. So we weren't sure how to make this decision. And it was basically, we could use that money or we could lose it. And okay.
As typical big company funding processes go, spend it or you don't get it back. Yep.
But like we weren't expecting to get it at all. So I mean, okay. Yeah. I mean, I'll take an opportunity that comes along, but I wanted to make sure that we made the right decision. And my colleague, Anthony Mastrian, who I've spoken about this before, like on my own podcast and things like that. He just, like he was saying, maybe the Simon guy, maybe the Simon Wardley guy has got some things figured out. And so we sat down, we tried to get into the material a little bit. And frankly, like it was really hard. We bounced out of it pretty quickly. And it was just a matter of sticking with it and sitting down in a conference room for a couple weeks on end until we finally started to get a glimpse of what was happening here. And basically, like what we learned was Wardley mapping is a way to make sense of these kinds of situations and how to make a good call. And at the end of the day, we chose to decline the money. We chose to actually move ahead with the strategy that we had really like accidentally stumbled into. But now we can make it explicit and actually tighten it up in a way that allowed us to have crisp answers to these kinds of questions. But like really like the thing we realized in the process was we didn't have an explicit strategy before. We were wandering, lost, like many people in the enterprise. Yeah, just going with the flow and making the best decisions we can in the situation. But this really highlighted how much we didn't know what we were doing. And that was the moment that changed.
Oh, that's wild. That's wild. So Ben, I'm gonna let you describe it because I'll bet you can do better than me. And I know this is not a great audio topic because you really need something ahead of you. So for those of you that are listening in the show notes, we're gonna have links to Ben's stuff. We're gonna have all the images that you need. So Ben, if you could, auditorily, I guess, orally, however, can you talk us through what a Wardley map looks like, and then let's talk about how we're actually going to use this.
Awesome, yeah. So a Wardley map is two things, basically. It is a visual way to represent a system oriented around users, and it is also a way to articulate how the parts of that system are changing. So that's the visual representation. And really, like, it's not that complicated. It's like nodes and edges. If you want to use the specific term, it's like a directed acyclic graph with position that has meaning. But like really, we're talking about circles and labels and lines between things and an axis that tells you where something is positioned from left to right. Like, that's basically all that's going on. Now, that particular axis is evolution. And evolution is kind of this other thing about Wardley mapping that is kind of like the secret sauce of it, right? It's the a way to describe how things change over time. And when I say things, like I really mean broadly, like what all the components inside a business, they're like activities, there's practices, there's data, there's knowledge, all these different kinds of things are changing over time, like starting out in the sort of uncharted space in Genesis where like, nobody's ever seen this stuff before. Mm-hmm. There's high potential for future value, but nobody understands it and it fails all the time. And maybe if it works once for a brief second, everybody gets really, really happy. But on the complete opposite side of the spectrum, there's the industrialized space, which is just everything's known, it's ordered, it's boring. We understand it completely. And if it fails, it's super surprising. So you can think
it's Oracle. It's Oracle, right? And we know, well, knock on wood, right? But we know what it is. It's a COTS system. You know what you're getting. You know, it's, I wouldn't necessarily use the word mature, right? But it's a product that's been out there in the marketplace that's generally expected that if I buy this, I get this. And it just is.
Yeah, there's this beauty, beauty of like the spectrum of options between those two kind of extreme endpoints. And like really like nothing is probably living or spending a lot of time on those extremes. But if we have a way to express where something is, the really cool thing is that we can talk about like what its characteristics are and how it behaves. And that also informs how we can decide how to treat it. And this might be like getting too far into like the weeds on this stuff just for our first couple minutes here, but like really a thing that's amazing about this is we can start thinking about a generalized way of describing how things change in a business and then how that change changes how we should treat it.
I think
that's the real big thing.
Right, the consistent realignment and reevaluation, which is what we pitch all the time in the Agile world, you know, small iterations, continuously look back, retrospect, and change. I think one of the things that jumped out at me regarding the graph that I thought was very, very insightful is the y-axis, right? And if anyone who's listening can picture, the top of the y-axis is visible, and the bottom of the y-axis is invisible. And when I look through, when I started reading Simon's book, you're right, it is very dense material, right? But when I started reading through it, and I think the example he uses is customer right in the middle, and that's a node. And then you start having what looks like a tree. But the further you go down the tree, it forces you to realize that I may be talking about bells and whistles and things that the customer may never see. Like we just talked about Oracle, right? Like the Oracle AR, Oracle AP, right? Which is bigger accounting software. Customer doesn't really care, right? They don't visualize that. All they know is I send my payment, my bill is credited, I get a bill. Whereas just conceptualizing where in the, I don't want to say value chain, but where in the visibility, the transparency of the actual inner workings, right? The voodoo chicken waving that goes on behind the scenes, where those things fall, I think is probably very powerful because it makes you think, to your point about, am I making the right decision at the right time?
Yeah, the visibility axis is really kind of a way of expressing relatively to the user where something is positioned. And as you were pointing out, like things that are really close to them, they're going to care about. Like, I mean, when I go to a coffee shop, I am caring primarily about the things that I'm interacting with there. It means like the amenities, it's the coffee itself, all that kind of stuff. But when I think about how all that stuff comes to be, I'm really not thinking about things like how the furniture was manufactured and what drill bit a carpenter used to put a hole in a chair leg. Like, or I'm not thinking about the particular brand of coffee cup that the store is giving me or whatever. Like all these kinds of things that are just a little bit further removed from the immediate experience that I'm having in the coffee shop. You know, those things matter a bit less. In a map, it's basically something called a value chain, which is that graph, that tree-like structure. And the thing that makes it a map is that those components are positioned horizontally according to the evolutionary stages. But visibility along that left-hand side, that y-axis, is kind of a really useful crutch for helping us just kind of keep in mind how the system is laid out and what people are caring about and what they're not caring about.
Right. And you just touched on, again, the evolution, which is the x-axis, if I remember geometry correctly. And it goes from Genesis, which is almost like blank space, undefined. Just by speaking it, you're willing it into existence. And then it steps through, I think it was custom built. Then it was a product. And then from there was an actual commodity, which back to the Oracle example, that is COTS system. I'm buying off the shelf. I know what I'm getting, right? Well, I'm getting what the manual says. If it works well, you know, that could be, you know, you install the wrong server, whatever. But when I started digging into the material and I started visualizing how I could use this, right? This is really something where, and we'll get to your notepad shortly, because I think that when you talked about being tactile, this is one of the things we almost lose in a lot of IT and knowledge work is we lack that tactile function. It's always just, you know, post-its are post-its, yes, but everybody has post-its. This is more purposeful. I could easily see sitting next to, like, my arm around my business partner and my architect on the other side saying, okay, let's draw through this and let's figure out where the things you're interested in obviously have a supporting architecture. And let's talk about where in the value chain they sit, because that may help us decide, do I build, do I buy? Is it customized off the shelf, or is it just we hire a couple of brilliant people and then figure out where we go from there.
Yeah. The mapping itself is like intended to be an extremely collaborative activity. And by that, I just mean the map helps us share a common model for how we're thinking about a space. And so what I'll do real quick is kind of point at a little bit more of the process of mapping as opposed to just the artifact itself. So producing the artifact is awesome because you create a model of the world. And the cool thing about models is that they're smaller than the world itself, which means we can think about them more easily. And like part of what I think of is like this idea from George Box, which basically says, you know, essentially all models are wrong, but some are useful.
Some are useful.
In addition to that, the other thing he says that it's important to be careful about what is actually importantly wrong and what is not such a big deal at all. And he points out a distinction between mice and tigers, basically. Like, if the model is wrong in ways that don't matter, who cares, right? Like, you don't need that level of granularity.
Right, right.
But if the model is wrong in a fundamental way that you and I disagree on the way that the system is working, that's a bigger issue. And that's something that a map helps highlight, because when we look at an artifact and we talk about it, we can start to come to sort of a consensus on what we think the system is. And that's when you start to run into the reality that we have label conflicts. When we think about what a word means and someone else is using that word, but that same word, but in a different way, suddenly we have a conflict. And as we're talking through it and contextualizing these things, it becomes a lot more clear that there's a conflict there and we can hash that out. So producing the artifact enables us to challenge it and talk to each other and be transparent about what we think the thing is and how it works. But it's part of a larger process. In fact, the artifact is just one step in five steps in what Simon calls the strategy cycle. And the origin of this is Simon spent a long time studying military history, studying how maps were used in military campaigns, and ended up reading Sun Tzu's The Art of War and a bunch of different translations of it to try to understand that material. And by the way, like, I think like there's probably a certain kind of way you think about people who read The Art of War and all this kind of stuff, but like, this is deep study. And if you're really interested in getting the context for this kind of stuff, there's a good book by Derek M.C. Nguyen called Deciphering Sun Tzu, which really gets into this stuff if you want to go deeper on it. But basically, Simon recognized a pattern in the material, which was the five factors in the strategy cycle: purpose, landscape, climate, doctrine, and leadership. And purpose is just like why we're all here together. It's the thing that's bigger than all of us, it's the game we're playing, right? Why do I show up to work every day? Why do I bother working for this company or that company, right? The landscape is the map. It's the thing we were just talking about. It's a representation of the competitive landscape. It's a way for us to sort of like look at what's going on. Like, what are the obstacles? What's in the way? How do things work? All that kind of stuff. Climate are the rules of the game, basically the things that we don't get control over, the external forces acting on that landscape. And doctrine is how we train ourselves, basically. The principles that we choose to apply universally, like things like always focus on user needs is a good example of that. And finally, the fifth step in the process is leadership. It's like the decision-making part is the last part, and it integrates all that context. And so the key thing that Simon is pointing at here is oftentimes in organizations, we jump straight from step one to step five. We jump straight from purpose to leadership. And so that's the pathway of just gut feeling, right? We have a strong purpose. We know why we exist. Great. We have vision statements. We have mission statements, all this kind of stuff. All right. Now we're going to go bomb that hill for some reason. Like, but why? Why are we going to go do that? So the process of sitting with that context, and my friend Tashin Fogelman has written like some posts on something called disfluency. It's like the process of slowing down just long enough to pay attention to, you know, really what's going on here. That disfluency of sitting with the context and those other steps in the process allows us to make more informed, more nuanced, more long-term thinking decisions. So that's a little bit of like that kind of background around the process. And it's really just a way to model our reality and interact with it meaningfully.
And I like how... And the word he used that's really powerful is the word doctrine, right? And the whole idea of, you know, physician heal thyself, like look in and figure out what is the modality that we're using to describe the system that we're in. You know, so you used a great example. It calls back to an episode we just did where you talked about how two people using the same word could have vastly different interpretations of that word. We just did an episode on domain-driven design. and how that applies to Azure transformation. And I always go back to, I had an old developer guy teach me this ubiquitous nomenclature. You know, when I say state, or when I say sales, or when I say marketing, words that you think everybody would have a near universal definition of, they don't. And, and one of the examples I always go back to is I listened to two guys argue about something they were calling the principle. And one of them was referring a loan amount, and another was referring to like something embedded in a data call. And they literally went back and forth for like 2 weeks and just arguing over the principle until finally the light bulb went off on somebody's head and they went, oh man, you're not talking about what I'm talking about. You know, I'm saying potato, you're saying potato, and they don't mean the same thing.
Yeah.
So that whole idea of looking at how we look at things is really, really powerful. So Ben, so we've got these five steps, right? We've got this artifact. It's very collaborative. So when should one think about using this type of tool, this type of application? I mean, share with me an example or two of someone who's listening. And like I said, our audience is a lot of Scrum Masters, a lot of product owners, a lot of Agile coaches, a lot of people who are open to new ideas. When should they have the light bulb go off to say, hey, this is probably something I should learn more and break out because I think it'll work?
Yeah, one of the things I think Wordly Mapping may have a bit of a reputation for right now is being primarily focused on enterprise level executive strategy. I think this is, in addition to that, if it's not enterprise level executive strategy, it's extreme like systems, software architecture kind of concerns. And I'm just going to kind of like maybe change the way that that may be perceived right now. Because I've used mapping, not just because it's my favorite hammer in my toolbox, but because it's actually been useful for things like personal introspection, basically to model my own self, kind of like create an ontology of what makes me tick, but then also to deliberately intervene in different ways if that works for myself. I've also used it in like quick little like hackathon contexts where basically I put on the hat of product manager for a second and we needed to build something quickly and basically not spend any time on anything else that didn't matter. And so having a map, creating an artifact where we agreed who we were serving, what they needed, what we were going to do about providing something to meet those needs, and then the system itself that we were going to build in order to make all that work. Like, and I guess the one additional thing was basically deciding which things to own. Frankly, when you're building something in a hackathon context or a quick kind of like iterative situation, you need to make really careful decisions about what not to own. And so in the one context I'm thinking of specifically, we were building an application for like an art gallery crawl thing. There was like a nonprofit that we were building something for. And basically we outsourced like 80% of our map of our design system to Google and Facebook. Like, yeah, we don't need to build all that stuff. Cool. All right, we're going to build this one thing. And that was kind of like the unique way that that was applied in that situation. But basically, the general rule of thumb for me is if it matters, like if I care about it, I'm going to spend just a little bit of time thinking about what the design of the system should be and just do a quick, maybe it's only happening in my head. Maybe it's only happening on the back of a napkin. Or maybe if I feel like taking it a little bit more seriously, I might draw it out on a whiteboard. Or there's also a Miro template if you want to get started online, like Miro, just Google Miro and Wordly Mapping. Like, I will take a moment to think about the system and what its parts are and which of those parts I should be owning because I care about the long term, right? So that is a little bit of a taste of it, but like this thing gets into like organizational design. It gets into really just how to think about how to design systems in general intentionally. And so, yeah, if you think bringing intentional thought to a problem space will, at least in terms of the design and how what the parts should be and how they should change over time, then yeah, like go into, get started with Wordly Mapping and just play around with it a little bit. Doesn't have to be super complicated. Like really.
Keep it simple. Yeah.
Yeah. You can start pretty high level and just like have a map with four parts and like four components in it and go like, yeah, so these represent the industry super high level. And we'll find the places where we need more detail as we go into it. Mapping is an iterative process. So if you make one that's broken the first time around, that's totally fine.
Mm-hmm.
You come around iteration two and you make it just a little bit better. There is no such thing as a perfect map.
That was one of the things that jumped out to me as a practice, as a technique, is it's elegant in its simplicity, But when you look at it, it's way, it may look simple, but it's actually not, right? Like if you actually take the time to, like you're saying, you draw it out in the back of a cocktail napkin, even still, that's way more powerful than you sitting there trying to regurgitate to someone in a meeting. Here's what I was thinking this. And you think about, I've spent a lot of time in the enterprise space. You think about the overpreponderance of like PowerPoint and Prezi, right? And that whole, it's not tactile, but that visual display of data, which isn't just a memo, where if Edward Tufte was on the call, I always say his last name wrong. I'd love to get him on and have him rant about PowerPoint. I'd probably pay him. But he talks about how, you know, those things can, when used well, can be very powerful. And for me, when I was reading your stuff, when I was reading Simon's, I was flipping through the book, just the power of being able to put something, like you said, first iteration, just put it up on a wall. And it's like a lot of the things we prescribe in the Agile world, just for to get a first pass up there and look at it. And then as you look at it, you'll have dialogue, which will lead to learning, which will lead to changes, which will lead to a better version of what you started at to begin with.
Yeah, I think a lot of people, when they get started with Worthy Mapping, they get really concerned that they're... And that may be the case. They may be completely messing it up. Who knows? But the reality of it is, do you start to build a common language? Do you start to build a common model of the system that you can share with someone else, from a different department, and they can kind of sort of get what's going on? Like, the real question at the end of the day is, did you learn something? Was communication easier? I think I heard like Kevin Baer say recently, like, your organization is basically limited by the ability of the insights to communicate with each other. And I'm just thinking about that. Like, if you can communicate just a little bit better between departments or between team members, like, how much better are the decisions that you're going to make going to be? So it's really not that complicated. It looks super messy and complicated at first, but like, trust me, it's not. It's literally users, what they need from you, how you meet those needs, and then all the parts in the system that come together to meet those needs, and really just how they change over time. And if you get stuck at any point, I want you to pick up the phone, open the Twitter app, and at message me on Twitter, at Hired Thought, and say, Ben, what the hell is going on? I don't get this part. And I will do whatever I can to help you take the next step.
That's awesome. That's awesome, Ben. Thank you. You know, you were just poking at something which I've been digging into as of late, that idea of interorganizational communication, right? So Niels Flagling, the guy who wrote the book Open Space, Open Space Beta, the Beta Codex, he talks about your informal and formal networks inside of an organization. You know, there's formal, informal, and then there's the value-based. And I'm starting to see a lot more dialogue around that, around if you sacrifice your informal network for the service of the formal, right? So if Ben is a senior director and Jay is a director and Jay is three people below him, right? That overemphasis on the formal side of it and not the informal, where Ben happens to know Simon, who knows Dave, who knows Jay, and just that, not the water cooler type stuff, because it's probably at this point it's becoming a dated example, right? Nobody has water coolers anymore. But that whole idea of that unofficial lines of communication can be very, very powerful in an organization. When we just had Jason Little on to talk about organizational change, and he talked about how some of those things, it's like it's very hard to pass them by, right? It's very hard to overcome them if you have a very, very strong interpersonal, unofficial, informal network. So you're right, that whole put it up on the paper and let's all talk about it, you level set that experience and you level set that conversation where people can then take it from there.
Which can be terrifying, to be honest. Like,
oh, absolutely.
Especially if you're an executive or someone who's used to being the person who calls the shots, the really humbling thing about something like Worthy Mapping is that you become transparent. And that is a wonderful thing because it invites challenge, and challenge means that you'll make better decisions overall. But it does invite challenge, and that's going to be kind of terrifying at first, especially for people who are used to calling the shots.
And I think to your point about how it's authored collaboratively, right? And you have multiple people working on it. It's the same thing as value stream mapping, where if you do it collaboratively, at the end, you may come out with a result where you go, holy shit. Like, how do we function? Like, if this is how things are set up, one of my co-board members, James Gifford, talked about how he went through a value stream mapping exercise, not Worthy Mapping, but value stream mapping. Shout out to Karen Martin. And at the end, he had an executive stand up at the table and go, how the hell do we make any money? our process is so screwed up. Like, and you're, so to your point, that transparency, it creates the opening for that uncomfortable conversation that one may not normally, in a room full of people who are three steps below you on the food chain, you may not normally stand up and say, well, this is sort of stupid.
Yeah, that honestly will probably, as we see mapping proliferate over the next few years, that will probably be one of the biggest obstacles to mapping is the existing power dynamics and power structures in organizations. And that's okay. I think those are normal human problems to have. And to that point, if you start mapping with a friend or a colleague and you start thinking about a space, and at the end of that session, you go, holy shit, what is happening here? Great. Congratulations. It's day one. You have enormous amounts of time to make things better. And what I'll say also about that is don't look at what you learn in a map as being something that should encourage like an instant transition to something better. Like Simon, one of the doctrinal principles is to correct bias and remove duplication, right? You can't just do that overnight a lot of times, especially in the enterprise where you might have hundreds. I think the example Simon gives in his book is like, there was a bank with like thousands of risk management systems that were basically fulfilling the same function. And like, you can't just like wake up the next day and go, well, we solved it. We found the duplication. We can just kill all the others now. We can just have one. But you can't do that. These are transitions that have to be designed. And this is something that my mentor, Jay Bloom, talks a lot about. He points at how this can't just be a switch flip. And in addition to that, there's a fellow named Andrew Clay Schaefer who talks about essentially transformation. Like we have this idea of transformation where we just wake up one morning and we're transformed and the agile DevOps rainbow pandas scream in the clouds and we're all like wonderful. But he points at this really important idea, which is, look, are you making those tiny changes that help you make 1% better decisions every day? Are you turning 1% into 5% and 5% into 10%? And over time, are you eventually making more good decisions than bad decisions? Mm-hmm. It's all about that daily progress towards something that makes more sense. So yeah, if you wake up after a map and you go, oh no, this whole thing is a mess, it's okay, right? Most organizations are experiencing the same issues and you are now aware of them, whereas they are not. So congratulations.
I was going to say that would probably be the best thing that you could hope to happen is the enlightenment that came from, you know, there's that old saying, I think I stole it from Jeff Patton, where scope doesn't creep, but understanding grows. And he, I think he uses that in the user story mapping book, but I use that all the time because if you think about it, it's a good statement. It's the scope isn't creeping. Yeah. You're learning more. So you were naive to even think you knew everything to start. But I finished this map and I went to my buddy Gifford, to James's executive, standing up and saying, holy shit, how do we make money? This is so backwards. You're better off because, like you said, you've had that light bulb. Ben, let me ask you. So a couple of last things before we wrap up. I want to be considerate of your time. So any hints, tips, tricks for anybody looking to get into this? Where any things that you've learned through through battles, through prize fights that you could impart with the audience?
Yeah, I think the first thing is that we're all still learning a lot about how this works. And kind of just to do a very like quick aside on what mapping is, it looks an awful lot like ontology. Like creating a structure for the world to categorize the parts of it and name them and see how they relate to each other. And that is like something that I think that's a part of philosophy and like those people don't always have it figured out either. So what I'll say is just like, it's going to feel weird. It's going to feel like you don't know what you're doing and that's okay. And oftentimes I sit down to map something out and I'm just like, wow, it sure feels like I don't know what I'm doing. And that's totally okay. Totally normal. This is just the process is figuring out how to work through that problem. The other thing I'll say is if you can, find someone else who's mapped before if you're doing it for the first time and just see if you can tag along with them. There are a ton of people in the Worldly Mapping community who are more than happy to provide critique or to provide suggestions, or if you have questions, like really like you can just go on Twitter and search for the hashtag Worldly Maps and you'll find a bunch of people who've been squawking about it. And I'm certainly one of them, but yeah, it's like find someone who's mapped before. And if not, like there's a lot of good, like little videos that are starting to pop up now. Corey Foy has something called Mapping Mondays, where you can see like a quick little explanation of a concept with an example, and like just go on YouTube and search for worldly maps now. Like you can find some examples that kind of give you a basic idea of what's, you know, what it looks like. And yeah, don't get stuck. Reach out for help. Like this community is solid. These people are awesome and they are very happy to help you.
That's awesome. So Ben, you mentioned it early on, so I'm going to come back to it. You have your own podcast. So let's do some free PR here. So let's talk about your show. So what is your show about?
Oh, I really appreciate that. That's nice of you. So my show is called The Hired Thought Podcast. You can find it on podcast apps near you, or you can go to hiredthought.com/podcast. My show is really focused on my guests, I think, as all podcasts are or try to be or should be. And my guests tend to be people who are thinking for a living, maybe not so often the ones who you might see being lauded for taking brave action in the face of scrum fires or something like that. Like we're talking about like maybe the folks that don't always get to tell their side of the story. And so I'm only 3 episodes in at the time of this recording, and number 4 is on its way soon. I'm really excited about it. But my first few guests have just been like people who worked in government, in socio-technical systems, recognized the people factors that were going on. My former colleague from the story about how I got introduced to worldly mapping, I had him on for episode 2. And episode 3 was with someone who's building a meditation app called Bright Mind. And it's a really kind of fascinating dive into how meditation and technology overlap. So a little bit eclectic, but if you look closely, my business may be Hired Thought, but the LLC underneath it is called Odd Duck LLC. So I think that maybe speaks to my taste in guests. Yeah,
you're letting your true colors shine through.
My freak duck fly.
So Ben, getting close to the end here. So if people want to find more of you, they want to reach out to you, they want to find more about worldly mapping, where do they go to find you?
Yeah, I'm super active on Twitter and I'm at Hired Thought on there. You can also find my website at hiredthought.com. I will also mention that if you want to dip your toes into worldly mapping, you can go to learnworldlymapping.com and just kind of dive into the material that's there and really just Google for worldly mapping. There's stuff everywhere now. It's great. So yeah, hit me up on Twitter. I would love to hear from you and hear what the context that you're dealing with is, what you're struggling with, the challenges that you have trying to learn this stuff. Or really just like, hey, Ben, what the hell is this? Should I learn it? And I'll tell you yes and tell you why. And you know, we'll go from there. But yeah, I'd love to hear from you and talk to you.
And along those lines, I don't want to skip it. We talked very early about the tactile piece. And this is how I actually ended up meeting you, was you sell worldly mapping pads on your website. Can you give us a little bit about that? Like, how did that come about where you said, you know what, I want to build my own print shop and print these things?
Yeah. Well, and that's the fun thing about worldly mapping is when you say that you follow the doctrinal principles of this process, things like not building things that you shouldn't build and maybe buying things that you should buy instead, it's kind of fun whenever someone like me goes off and does something kind of weird like that. So it kind of started like really like there's this idea that material things are maybe a little bit more present. And right now, worldly mapping lives in a couple places, right? It lives in Medium posts on the internet. It lives in other people's blog posts. It might be on Twitter and all this kind of stuff. And I think that having something physical really helps remind you that it exists and reminds you of the principles that are entailed. It just has a different kind of experience with it. And Simon himself says that you know, you don't need any sort of special fancy technology to do it. You just need the back of a napkin and a pencil. And so that was kind of like this motivation that I had going into it. But the real kind of moment for me was I was just wandering around my neighborhood one day, taking a walk, thinking about some things. And I walked by a print shop. I stopped in and I said hello and kind of got to meet the person that was running it. And I live in Pittsburgh, so lots of small little city-like kind of areas. So if you happen upon a print shop, you have to go meet that person and find out about them. That's kind of the way it works. So I do that and he hands me these two like notepad to-do list things. And they're supposed to be like advertisements for his print shop. And I was just like struck. I was like, okay, this is interesting. Wait a minute. What if this was a template for worldly mapping? That way people don't have to remember how to draw the axes and the structure and all this kind of stuff. And wow, this really looks like about the size of a napkin. Wouldn't that be great if this was a product that, you know, people could just get and kind of keep in their back pocket if they needed to. And really from there, it was just like, wow, okay, really the physical materials could help this thing grow and help people learn about it and make it less challenging. And so I was like, yeah, I'll sell these at cost. I'll just like throw them out there. I'll make sure people can find how to learn about the method by leaving the website on the notepads themselves, learnworthymapping.com. We'll see what happens. I threw up a landing page, tried to see if anyone would be interested. 50 people signed up. So I was like, all right, I guess I have to do this now.
Victim of your own successes.
No, yeah, and I'll tell you, like, the thing that I enjoyed most about it really is hand packing each one of these. Like, for someone who has to do all this like abstract thinking work every day, I'm just like, oh, you're telling me I can ship a physical product and write a note to them and say hello and just send it to them with love? And like, you're telling me I could do that and finish it and it'd be great? Yeah, I really love
it. There's something to be said for that. I did construction in between college years for my uncle. And there's something to be said for getting home at the end of the day and looking at something and going, I built that. I broke that. I took that apart. You know, like it's, you know, like, it goes back to that word tactile. Well, thank you very much, Ben. I don't want to take too much more of your time. On behalf of the Agile Uprising and our listeners, I really, really want to thank you for joining us. On behalf of Ben and myself, I want to thank all of you listeners for listening. There will be a plethora of show notes posted with this. We're going to have links to Ben's site, to Ben's podcast. We'll have links to Learn Wardley Mapping. Here I am from Lean In. We'll have stuff all over the place. So if you're interested, please hop on the coalition. There will be a thread posted. Let's continue the conversation. You're more than welcome to join us on our Discord server. We have a lot of vibrant conversation going on in there as well. The usual is we've got Patreon. We've got a Discord blog. We've got all this other stuff. So if you're interested, please hop in, find us, and find the conversation. We're all over Twitter. So Ben, once again, thank you very much. And this is Jay Hursko. And until next time, this is the Agile Uprising Podcast, signing out.
Thanks so much, Jay.
With the taste of flesh.
If you own a vehicle with less than 200,000 miles and have an auto warranty about to expire or no warranty coverage at all, listen up. CarShield has a low-cost, month-to-month vehicle protection plan that covers more parts than ever. Visit carshield.com/audio to find out how you could pay almost nothing for covered auto repairs. Drivers who activate this vehicle protection today will also receive free roadside assistance, free towing, and car rental options at no additional cost. Get your free quote today at carshield.com/audio. That's carshield.com/audio.